And who could have turned them on those I can find in? I think that I know what I haven't known yet. 'Cause a week is a month and an hour a day. When your reaching just pushes it further away now. With your past and your future precisely divided, am I that moment? I haven't decided.
Don't take another step.
It's stretching out into sea and what's on the horizon. Is that what the prophet told me you saw? You gave it to me, but I really don't want it. I came out on top by the luck of the draw. 'Cause a week is a month and an hour a day. When you're reaching just pushes it further away now. And what's the return on the faith I've provided? I think that I know now. Wake up in the morning.
plugging in.
Hi, everybody. We're live.
I'm so frustrated with this MixPre 3. I tried plugging it into different USB-C ports because right now, and the way it's always been, is I go via the Cal digit and then the Cal digit to the computer. Then I tried going via the monitor. I tried going via the computer directly. And what's the behavior is that when I hit record on the MixPre 3, which is the thing that the interface that goes from XLR to USB, when I hit record on that, and this started a couple of months ago, Audio Hijack will be like, I'm sorry. What microphone? What MixPre 3? That doesn't exist anymore. And then if I hit stop on the MixPre 3, then everything's good again. And I just don't understand what's going on. And it very well could be user error. I'm not saying it's not user error, but for the life of me, I don't know what's happening. I even tried going old USB, so it was a USB A to C, and I tried one of those cables just to see what if the USB-C port is funky some way, somehow. Nothing. So I don't know what's going on. It's driving me batty. But,
I mean, it seems like you have such a setup there. So one of my formative computing experiences, one of my best friends growing up in high school, you know, we had this group of friends, and we would all build each other, tower PCs and work on our PCs together and stuff like that. And one of my friends had a computer that just never really worked right. Like, there was always some weird, flaky, or not working thing.
Now, hold on. Don't you put that bad energy on me, Ricky Bobby. This computer has been fine. I've had it for 6, 7, 8 months. October.
Part of the reason why my friend Ben's computer was always having problems, we certainly thought this at the time, was that he insisted on having 1,000 different peripherals and carts in it. Like, he had like 5 hard drives. He had, 1,000 cards and other, like, so it was just like this massive conglomeration of just tons of stuff. And like, theoretically, yes, the motherboard supported that many drives. Yes, it had that many card slots. But we just know in practice with computers that the more stuff you add to a PC, the more likely you are that some weird little thing might go wrong sometimes. It just happens with complexity of a setup. Now, what you just said, Casey, was that you had something like 5 different ways you could have plugged this thing in.
And so do you.
Including,
it's the same story.
A hub, a monitor hub. And by the way, those monitors are not great monitors. there's all sorts of complexity in your
setup.
Studio
display. Come on, it's not that bad.
Well, but it's connected to the same computer as 2 LG Ultrafines, plus a Thunderbolt hub. There's all sorts of stuff that could introduce weirdnesses or unreliabilities because you have what sounds like a fairly complicated setup.
I don't know, man. First of all, this worked for literally years. I mean, this is the same setup I've had since I left the iMac Pro.
Every time we start the call for the podcast, you're like, oh, wrong mic. Oh, something went wrong. It's not just my USB interface.
That's true, but that's only been for the last couple of months. It's up until then, it was rock solid.
I can't believe you don't have your microphone directly connected to your computer. I can't believe you're going through anything. Monitor, hub, anything.
It's never been a problem before. And I tried again tonight.
But it's been a problem for 2 months.
Yeah, well. Anyway, that's not the actual pre-show. That's the bootleg special pre-show, which
that's
is the thing that we...
That's the pre-show. That's it.
All right, fine. And now I'm all grumpy. So I don't want to be grumpy. I'm so excited to talk to you two.
We're helping you debug your problem. So
by telling you your whole setup is
My first step, my late breaking tip is debug it before we're recording.
Well,
a different day.
I know. And that, all kidding aside, that is 100% on me. Whether or not the actual root of the issue is on me, which I take umbrage.
You'll find that out by debugging because you'll spend a day just sitting there trying everything you can think of, reading up on it, sending emails to Polkafossis, going through the whole 9 yards.
No, I agree with you, but I've been busy recently. I just got my body clock is somewhere around Iceland right now, so I don't know. I don't know what you want me to do. All right, let's do some follow up and try to make me turn this round upside down. So we have a just overabundance of follow up with regard to Marco's Rivian. And here's the thing, listeners: for the last several years now, I want to say 2 to 3 years, maybe even more than that, but for the last several years. Typically Wednesday mornings, what I'll do is I will often use that as an excuse to go to somewhere, maybe a local library, maybe Wegmans, which is a grocery store that has a really lovely cafe area, maybe Publix, another grocery store, similar story. And I'll go somewhere and I'll concentrate and focus on doing my ATP research because you two, and by that I really mean John, will put just oodles of links into the show notes, and I need to not only get a head start on the show notes that the listeners see, but I need to read and do all that stuff, and so I know what I'm talking about that evening. And this morning, this was my first full day back in the States in 2 weeks, which we may or may not talk about at some point on the show, and I sat down to do my research, and there are approximately 407 YouTube videos, each of which is like 35 minutes long, that John wanted me to watch. John, I have not done my homework, so I'm just going to start reading and jump in when you're ready. So Matt Rigby writes with regard to Marco's Rivian Repair. Here's an R1S dent and repair build that's almost identical to Marco's on the Becky and Chris YouTube channel. And I did watch a couple of minutes of this, and this appeared to be, because John helpfully provided a timestamp link, this appeared to be a, hey, here's what we think several months later about their Rivian, and they noted that apparently when you are in off-road mode, and I think, Marco, you might have said this as well.
Yes.
Anyway, when you're in an off-road mode, the proximity sensors are turned off, which I both get and think is absolutely bonkers. I can make a strong argument either way. And they bumped into a tree, not dissimilar from the way Marco did, and the repair bill was something like $40,000. The difference, though, is that they went to a paintless dent repair, or whatever it's called, PDR place, and they had it fixed, and it looked almost good as new, which, although I think the wrap that they did around it probably helped in that department, and they spent considerably less than $40,000 or whatever your bill was.
No wrap required. None of this slamming PDR. PDR can make it as perfect as can be. That's what they show in these videos. They love showing the close-ups with the bright light shining on it, so you can see that it's not just sort of okay. It's perfect. It's good as new.
Yeah, so turns out, Marco, you didn't have to spend $40,000 on insurance's money. You could have spent
in all fairness, it was 20, but also, yeah.
Oh,
it was,
sorry, my mistake.
It was what insurance told me to do. That's it. Like, I went to insurance, I said, hey, here's my problem. And they said, okay, go to a body shop. This is what they'll do. Like, you know, I figure at that point, it's in their hands how they choose to do it.
Yeah. Then Marco was kind enough to share his final bill from the body shop privately with John and I. We will not be sharing this publicly unless Marco's feeling particularly forthcoming, which I doubt.
Nope.
John, I presume, was the one who decided to go through with a fine-tooth comb and come up with a few figures. So, John, can you take us through this, please?
Sure. I asked last time. I wanted to know what the parts and labor breakdown was, and I got that breakdown. So parts was 39% of the total cost, and the top four most expensive parts on there were the RT Uniside Assembly Quarter Panel for $2,751, which is pretty good. Like, that panel, which we'll get to in a little bit, that's a low price. Like, I've seen tiny pieces of sheet metal on expensive cars cost four times that much. So, hey, not so bad. The bumper cover coming in at number two at $940. I don't know what that is, but it sounds like too much for a bumper cover. RT tail lamp assembly, $630. And finally, RT quarter glass. I didn't even know they would replace the quarter glass. So maybe it doesn't, I guess it's part of the body panel. Maybe it doesn't come out and go back in like a windshield. They just have to break it or just, it gets chucked. But anyway, that was $537. So those are the top four things. And so parts was about 39%.
So labor is RT not right? Isn't that right? Tail lamp
assembly? Probably right. Probably right. I'm trying to expand the things. I was confused by the fact that it's like, Rivian truck, RT, RT1,
it could be
R1S. I don't know. You're right. It's probably right and left. I'm being silly. Although it is all caps, which is weird. Anyway, so those are all right. Right, Uniside assembly. Uniside, what a word. 53% labor. So the majority of the cost was labor, and then miscellaneous and taxes was 8%. So that's the breakdown. Surprisingly inexpensive parts, although there were a lot of them. A lot of labor, including, I think, part of that 53% labor was like $1,300 to calibrate everything after they reassembled it.
Woof. It's a lot of money. And then, John, you provided, just to really rub Marco's face in the pee stain that he left on the carpet, to use a dogism, you included three different videos where they talk about the magic of PDR.
You should never do that to a dog, first of all. And second of all, if you're wondering what paintless dent repair is like, I provided three videos. Two of them are Rivian videos, is one. One is a different vehicle, but the person explains the process with some terrible backing music behind it. watching it be done, it looks like it's impossible. It looks like a trick, but I assure you, you can just Google or search YouTube. There are so many of these videos. All of these people aren't scam artists. They're obviously good at what they do, and they're making YouTube videos of it. I'm sure it's difficult to find someone who's as good as these people on the channel, but they somehow managed to painstakingly restore these pieces of sheet metal to looking like new by hitting it with things and pulling it with things. It's fascinating.
Indeed. All right. And then why don't we talk about that side panel? Because here's the thing. I genuinely am enthusiastic that there are entries into the automotive market 120, 150 years, whatever it's been since the, you know, car has really been a mass produced thing. It doesn't matter how many years, a long time. And Tesla started and showed us that, yes, you know, some plucky upstart could make a car company and then have a Nazi turn out to be at the helm, but that's neither here nor there. But, you know, they weren't the greatest at putting cars together, certainly at first. Maybe they're a little better now. But they also made a lot of really weird choices, and it looks like Rivian is following right in their footsteps, because what the hell is this?
This is the R1S side panel. We'll provide a link to the Rivian Forums website where someone posted this picture. You can't tell from the picture whether this is actually a series of parts that are put together in the factory into one large part or whether it really is one large part. Presumably it's welded together from smaller pieces. But the picture shows a whole bunch of these pieces of metal hanging in a factory. So this is clearly like a single thing that gets attached to the car. And presumably when Marco got his repair, this is what they had to remove from his car. And then they ordered one of these from the factory and put a new one on the car. And when you look at this and think about where his dent was, and think about this is the size of the piece that they have to replace, think of all the things that attach to that piece, including the rear quarter window, the roof, both of the doors, all the rear bumper, like the whole nine yards. It makes sense why it would cost so much. Now, I think it's a bargain to pay $2,700 for this piece of sheet metal because it's huge. So you're really getting your money's worth there. But yeah,
it really makes the pro stand seem like a poor value.
Exactly. There's at least three or four XDR stands inside and sheet metal in this thing. So yeah, check out the picture if you really want to see a visualization of what they had to remove and then replace and repaint on Marco's car.
Yeah, it's basically disassembling like the entire right half of the car. Like that, like it, when you see the size of this piece and how much of the car it represents, it makes a lot more sense. Now, I think you can make a good argument, like maybe this is a poor design.
Exactly.
Like, if you know, talk about design for repairability, this is definitely not designed for repairability at all. This is design, this is like the total opposite. This is like, what is the least repairable design we can possibly make? Let's do that, and let's make it include one of the most commonly dented parts of a car. Great.
Yeah, I mean, I really wonder what the trade-off is there. Maybe it's faster to assemble. Maybe it's more sturdy because there are fewer joints. I have to think that this is made from multiple pieces that are welded together in the factory. But still, I think this is the part that you buy. I don't think you can buy any other part. Like, if you just wanted, like, the back part, you can see certain parts of it are clearly just one piece of metal. Maybe, like, the roof and the other things are welded to it. But if this is the part they sell you, this is what you have to buy.
It might just be, like, stamped out in this shape.
Yeah, that's what I thought.
It looks like one solid panel.
That would be a huge stamping. I think it has to be multiple pieces. But either way, I've seen this. There's other Rivian videos you can see where someone will buy one of these pieces. In this case, it was like a pickup truck. And they'll cut a piece off of it. They'll buy the whole piece. You got to buy the whole thing. But then they'll cut a piece off. And then they'll cut the same shape piece off of their dented car and sort of fudge them back together. And that gets back to what I was saying before about insurance companies want you to make it like new, right? In the end, it should look just like a new one. So you can't, you know, cut and paste pieces of pieces. And also, the insurance company doesn't want it to be reliant on the artistry of a craftsperson doing PDR, because that is a highly skilled thing. And it's not, I mean, not that saying that, that doing body work isn't is highly skilled as well, but it is, it seems even more dependent on the expertise of the person than regular body work, which I don't know. Maybe I'm wrong about this. Someone who does body work, let me know. Is PDR actually harder or easier than regular body work, or is actually regular body work harder because you have to do all the filler and everything? But either way, I kind of understand both sides of this. Even this single piece, like we'll get to in a second, I think a lot of car manufacturers do this because you don't want to have your robots welding 800 different things on the assembly line. You want to just take the big one piece, put it on, weld it in five places, and be done with it. Fewer squeaks and rattles, better structural integrity, better stiffness, fewer parts. Like, it all makes sense until you get a tiny ding, and then it makes far less sense.
And then apparently it's not just Rivian. Blaine wrote in with regard to similar story. So Blaine writes, I was recently hit by a large lifted truck while on my 2019 Jaguar. Sorry, I was just in Britain. Jaguar F-Type. His bumper hit right where my door and rear quarter panel came together, denting them and then scraping along the side above my wheel well. Because the panels are aluminum and glued together for rigidity, cutting out the dented bit and patch wasn't an option, so both had to be fully replaced for a total cost of $32,588.84. Holy crap.
I have to think a lot of that is the increased cost of the panels. When I mentioned more expensive cars where the panels cost a lot more than the $2,700 that the whole side of Marco's car cost, Jaguar would be one of those examples of a brand where your body panels are going to cost more. And to be fair, this had, if you look at the size of this dent, it does span two big body panels. It's basically the whole side of the car. But yeah, it's not just Rivian. It's basically any modern car with like aluminum unibody instruction. I think the trend has been towards fewer and fewer pieces, towards, you know, fewer larger pieces, because presumably because that's less expensive for manufacturing and increases stiffness and everything.
Yep, at the expense of your insurance rates. Mm-hmm. Thanks to people like me. Sorry.
Yep, thanks, Marco. All right, so we got a fair bit of feedback with regard to, I think it was an Ask ATP question about, hey, where should EV chargers, the ports on board the car, where should they be? And the answer, according to a bunch of Europeans in particular, is the curbside. So this is best exemplified by Craig Ritchie, who writes, when you were discussing optimum EV charge socket position, you didn't discuss the possibility of charging when parked at the side of the road in a parallel parking position. This may not be as much of a factor in the US as it is in the UK, but as we all move inevitably towards EVs, it is likely many will charge their cars outside their homes on the main road. And so there you go.
Yeah, makes this was really interesting. Like, you know, because we had said, like, the passenger side is the worst side, because it is true that when you are, like, you know, charging in your own garage or, you know, at a fast charger or, you know, on a long highway trip, that is the less convenient side. But this was a really good point that, like, if you happen to have curbside charging and you park on the street, which is, I think, very unusual in most of the U.S., but is much more common in places that are more sensible, then it actually does make sense to have charging on the passenger side of the car, because that is the side next to the curb. So, interesting option. I think it's still, I think for U.S.-based vehicles, for North American vehicles, I would say still driver's side, because there is just not anywhere near enough curbside available charging here in the U.S. It just doesn't exist.
Yeah, I've never seen it, but I like this. The idea of having curbside charging things like this. We have a picture here that shows like a cord seemingly coming from a tree to charge an EV. It's as fantastical in our country as protected bike lanes and like reliable train travel and stuff. Like, we just do not have things that the rest of the world has, and curbside charging is definitely one of them. I'm sure it exists in the U.S. But so many people wrote in, this must be so much more common elsewhere than it is here. I've literally never seen it in my life.
Neither have I. I've driven an EV for a long time now in a lot of places on the Eastern Seaboard. Never seen this available anywhere.
It makes sense in cities like, where people don't have parking, right? Like, you don't have you don't have a garage or driveway. Total sense. We just, like, so many things that make total sense, we don't have it.
Yeah, I mean, it's one of the things that is hardest for EV adoption in a lot of places for a lot of people is, what if you live in an apartment and you don't have a garage, or, you know, there's like, you park on the street as your main parking spot? How do you charge your EV? It's a great question. It's a huge barrier to adoption for lots of people. It's a very important thing that we need to solve, but we have not even begun to solve it in the U.S., and it seems like nobody cares to. And it's the kind of thing that, like, culturally speaking in the U.S., I can't see us getting our act together to do this. I see it being a very much like, you know, this is my land, get off my land, you're not going to use my power kind of thing. Like, there's all sorts of problems with it that I think in practice with U.S. culture that I think would make it very difficult for us to adopt it anytime soon.
Like, you know, like protected bike lanes and streets made for people and not cars and all that good stuff. It only takes one, you know, high profile city to actually do this and to see the massive return on investment that they know they'll get from it based on every place else in the world that has ever done this and studied it to be a story to say, hey, I visited City X in the United States, and you know what? It was really pleasant, and they had curbside charging, and you could walk on the streets and not get run over, and, you know, fewer cars driving back and forth, and mass transit. Like, it just takes one or two examples to get the ball rolling. Hopefully we can get there eventually, but we are very, very far behind the rest of the world. So fingers crossed there. I don't think it's an impossibility. Like, municipal broadband is another great idea that's happened in a few places, still hasn't quite caught on. But some kind of citywide charging network probably run by some private company that takes all the profits and doesn't maintain the machines. Anyway, we'll see what we can do. On this topic also, though, one other person pointed out slash surmised that I was mentioning, like, Hondas have the gas filler on the driver's side.
It's called the gas hole.
Yeah. The notion that, that filler is actually on the passenger side, because Honda is a Japanese company and they do right-hand drive, and they just don't bother changing where the gas goes in when they sell it in America. So they move the steering wheel, but they don't move the gas filler. So I don't know if there's any truth to that, but it is interesting to think about. I'm pretty sure if you buy a Honda in Japan, the gas filler is still on the same side that it is on my car, but the steering wheel is not.
Yeah, and so David Barber wrote in, I bought a Subaru Ascent a few years back, and I recall wondering why they would put the gas port on the passenger side. After a bit of digging around, it seems this is a safety feature. Say you run out of gas on a busy highway or road. If you pull off the road and return with a gas canister, you'll find yourself on the side of the car farthest from traffic. That's clever.
Yeah, I'm not sure if that's the reason. It's definitely a consequence of the decision, but I'm not sure that running out of gas and having to go get a gas can is common enough to dictate the side of a car that the gas port is on. But who knows? Maybe that's where the trend started back when this was more common.
Indeed. All right. So we have a series of reports, and we didn't record for two straight weeks because I was overseas. So apologies. But apparently, as per, what is this, the 28th of July, so just a few days ago as we record, Apple Intelligence is reportedly delayed until iOS 18.1 in October. This is reading from Bloomberg. Apple Inc.'s upcoming artificial intelligence features will arrive later than anticipated, missing the initial launch of its upcoming iPhone and iPad software overhauls, but giving the company more time to fix bugs. The AI features will arrive a few weeks after the initial iOS 18 and iPad OS 18 releases planned for September. The release plan for Apple Intelligence presents the possibility that the first iPhone 16 model shipped to customers this year will lack the new AI features and require a software update weeks later. Even when Apple Intelligence launches with iOS 18.1, iPadOS 18.1, it will be missing some features that include some of the most significant changes to Siri, such as the ability to use on-device data to help find queries, and for the system to use what is on a person's screen to provide context for answers. The company is planning to roll out its full set of Apple Intelligence features via multiple updates to iOS 18 across the end of 2024 through the first half of 2025.
When I first saw the story, I was confused. I'm like, wait a second. Apple has always said that Apple Intelligence features are going to be delayed. And in fact, I thought they were going to be delayed until iOS 18.4. So what is this story about? But from what I've been able to gather since then, I believe what it's saying is that the original plan was iOS 18 ships. Let's just use iOS 18 for this placeholder for all the other OSs. iOS 18 ships, and it comes with some of Apple Intelligence, and then later in iOS 18.4 or whatever, you get the rest of it. And now it seems like the story is iOS 18 ships, you get none of Apple Intelligence. You wait for 18.1, you get some of Apple Intelligence, then you wait for 18.4 or whatever, and you get the rest of it. Which is not great, because Apple's going to be selling new phones, and it would be great if they could advertise, hey, buy an iPhone 16 and get the amazing new Apple Intelligence. But if the phone doesn't ship with that, and also that OS isn't out when you buy the phones on day one, harder to make that ad, isn't it? So it's not great for Apple. But on the other hand, like, I'd much rather have them not ship the software if it's not done. Like, I don't, you know, it's not a big deal, but like, this probably will make the roll less dramatic. On the other hand, being able to launch the iPhone without the risk of Apple Intelligence being terrible also simplifies matters. And it's just like, you know what? The iPhone 16 is going to live or die on its own merits without worrying about some embarrassing high-profile AI-related flub that becomes a big story with the launch of the iPhone. We'll wait until 18.1 to have that happen.
That actually might be a really good reason in itself to not have it be too tied to the launch. Because look, like, as far as like using Apple Intelligence to sell the iPhone 16 line, they have a whole year to promote the iPhone 16 line. And they're going to, you know, they throughout the whole year, they use different marketing techniques to push the new phone or the current generation phone as they need to throughout the year. Not every, you know, massive big press thing is pulled out at the very beginning. And in part, it's because not everybody buys phones all at once at launch day. Many people wait until certain, you know, payment plans are up, or, you know, they're up for credits at their carrier or whatever. Also, they have supply constraints. You know, they can't necessarily, you know, in recent years, the iPhones have not been hard to get. But you know, sometimes, like, if there's, like, a really hot new color, you know, that might be backordered or whatever. Like, so they do have to try to spread the love for the iPhone across more of a time span, across, hopefully, the entire year. So I think you're right, John. Like, I bet they really shouldn't probably bind these things together in, you know, too closely in people's minds that, like, Apple Intelligence is a feature of this new phone. Like, they probably shouldn't do that, in part because it's not actually true. It's going to work on the 16 or the 15 Pro as well.
It's not true, but it's truer than it has ever been, because Apple Intelligence literally only works on the new phones they're introducing and last year's Pro phone only.
Yes,
right?
Correct. But
so that
that's
is
a lot
the
of
narrowest it's ever been.
It is, but, like, a lot of people buy the Pro phones, so it's not that narrow. But, it, you know, it is, you're right, it isn't the narrowest it's been. But anyway, I do think it's wise to not tie the fate of the iPhone in people's mind, PR-wise, with the launch of a bunch of LLM-based features that are going to be brand new and shipping around the same time. So this makes total sense to, like, separate this by a few weeks. Like, you know, get this out, get the new phones out, get all the reviews of the new phones with Apple Intelligence not on those phones, and then later in the year start pushing this more heavily once you can roll it out with reasonable scale and once you've ironed out the biggest of the problems and things like that. So this makes total sense to me.
I think they will actually, when it comes time to pitch the Apple Intelligence things, for simplicity's sake, just pitch it as a feature of the iPhone 16. Because, yes, we know that you can run it on the 15 Pros or whatever, but that's such a complicated message to get across. Just say, you know, Apple Intelligence on the new iPhone 16. It doesn't say that it's only on the iPhone 16, but
right.
If you just keep saying Apple Intelligence on the iPhone 16 as the tagline in your ad or whatever, people will get the idea that, oh, I want one of those Apple Intelligence phones. I think that's the iPhone 16, which is true, it is, but also, you know, 15 Pro. Presumably they'll stop selling the 15 Pro and Pro Max, right, like they normally do with the Pro phones. You won't even be able to buy them, so it'll be kind of true unless you're going to buy a used one. Anyway, every review will say in part of their minuses column, like, oh, it's a shame that Apple Intelligence isn't out. But they're all just going to say, well, we'll see how that turns out, right? Obviously, ideally, Apple Intelligence would be 100% ready and it would roll out all at once and it would be amazing. But that's not the world Apple has been living in for the past many years, even though they've been having, quote-unquote, annual OS releases. Every WWDC, it's like, and here's the features that will be out on launch, and here's the ones that will be there later this year or the spring, or, you know, like, there's always some later stuff, and at a certain point it becomes kind of a farce to say they have annual releases, because it's like, well, this is the headline feature and it's not going to be in the 0.0, and it's not even going to be in the 0.1. It'll probably all be in the 0.4. Just, all right. Anyway, I mean, it's not at the farce point now, because really they are major releases and each new OS does bring a ton of things with them. But it's getting to, like, when we talk about the OSs, it's not like, oh, on launch day, we get to try out all the new features. I was thinking about this for, like, future shows and topics. Like, when should we talk about feature X? It's like, oh, when will that even be on our phones? When will it be in the betas? It's harder and harder to look at this as a annual giant bundle of goodies that drops on our head. It's a giant bundle of announcements that gets dropped on our head at WWDC, but the goodies trickle out over the year. And like I said, I would much rather have software be held back until it's ready. But it does get a little bit frustrating to announce it all at once, but then dole it out a little piece at a time. Especially when it's almost impossible to keep track of which pieces are being doled out at which time, especially with Apple Intelligence. Certain features that people think are Apple Intelligence aren't actually Apple Intelligence, and which there's like been 50 stories about which features of Apple Intelligence are in the 18.1 beta, will be in 18.2, 18.4, and those stories will keep coming because it's confusing. It'll be great when we get over this hump and say, finally, all the features of Apple Intelligence are out, and that'll happen probably around WWDC 2025.
And then we had an additional bit of news.
You missed the next week's qualifier.
Oh, sorry. Thank you.
I do have one more Apple Intelligence thing to say on this topic.
Oh, give yourself a clean break, because now we're all...
Yeah, I will. All right.
Okay, all right.
Have any of you tried the betas of anything with Apple Intelligence?
I haven't tried any of the betas of literally anything this year. Not yet, because I've been traveling and I didn't want to mess with it.
I also have not tried any of the 18 betas because I was like, I'm doing this big Overcast thing. Like, I wanted to, like, get that done and not be distracted or sidetracked by beta stuff for this fall. So I'm like, you know what? It's not that big of a year for most, like, you know, API-based things that we can actually use yet. Because, like, you know, developers still can't do anything with Apple Intelligence at all. Like there is no API we can use. Even for us to expose our app intents to the system, that's not even being indexed yet by Apple Intelligence. Like, so there is literally nothing for developers to do involving Apple Intelligence at all. So the iOS 18 summer for developers is pretty light. It's, you know, make sure your icon works with the new icon theming stuff, and not much else. Like, you know, maybe control center.
And find out what broke, right? And also,
yeah, but
if
like
you
it's
decide...
not that much. Also, we all know as developers that if anything breaks, we will know on WWDC Monday, because our customers will install developer beta 1 on day 1 and then will tell us what's broken. So I have a good reason, and I think Casey has a good reason too, because you don't want to travel internationally running a beta if you can help it.
Yep. Yeah, and I have some more travel coming up in September, which I'm sure we'll talk about on the show, but not quite yet. And so because of that, I don't think I'm going to be running the betas, certainly not on my phone, maybe on my iPad. Typically, I'll crumble toward the end of the public beta cycle, even though I do have, obviously, access to the developer betas. Typically, I don't like messing with those in the last couple of years. And so maybe in the next, you know, one or two public releases, I'll put it on the iPad just to see. But no, I haven't messed with any of it. And honestly, I think maybe I'm just getting old and crusty, but I don't. First of all, unnecessary. Second of all, accurate.
I mean, I'm no better.
But anyway, I think it's just, it doesn't. Living on the bleeding edge in that regard doesn't really rev my engine like it used to. But John, I think Marco and I haven't given you a chance to answer your own question. What's your situation?
Well, I have actually installed the, so they split the beta. There's 18.0 betas, and there's a beta train, 18.0 beta 4 or whatever they're on. Then there's also the 18.1 beta train, which is separate. So you could, they're releasing new ones in each of the trains at the same time. So on my Mac, which is running Mac OS 15, there's the 15.0 beta and then the 15.1 beta. And the 15.1 beta is the one that has some Apple Intelligence stuff in it. So I installed the 15.1 beta, not on my real machine, but on, you know, an external drive, and discovered that there's a wait list to try Apple Intelligence stuff in all the OSs. You have to like click a button that says, join the wait list for Apple Intelligence. And I clicked that button on my Mac, and it seemed to do nothing. It didn't disable the button. It didn't tell me that I'm on the wait list. It literally did nothing. So I clicked it a few more times and then gave up.
Is it in the settings app?
Yes.
There you go.
Yeah. Anyway, I did that. I don't know if it did anything. I hope I'm on a wait list. If I'm not on a wait list, who knows? Also, there was someone else posted something that like it was code completion. Like the Apple Intelligence powered code, whatever thing in Xcode, does not work if you are running Sequoia beta from an external drive. Like, there's a tooltip to that effect that someone posted a screenshot of. Boggles the mind. Anyway, I'm not installing Sequoia beta on my main drive, so I will just, you know, continue to monitor the betas to see what's in there. But yeah. Oh, and by the way, the other thing that developers could be doing over the summer for the new OS releases is they could be doing Swift 6 stuff, which we've talked about in a whole big interview show that you can listen to.
Indeed. All right, let's do some other topics. So here's the thing. I flew to the UK. Apparently, I'm just doling this information out in bits and pieces over the course of the episode, which is not the original plan, but here we are. So I flew over to the UK on what day was that? It was Tuesday the 16th in the evening, you know, arrived midday the 17th. And it was 2 days later. So impeccable timing from me. Thank you very much. 2 days later, we got the Y2K bug presented slightly differently and 24 years late. But we were in the UK. I forget exactly what we were doing that day, but somebody asked if I was like paying attention to the CrowdStrike thing. And I was like, I'm sorry, what? And the name rang a bell, and I couldn't figure out why until later that day. I saw images of the Mercedes F1 team, which is sponsored in a part or no small part by CrowdStrike. I saw their pit wall setup establishment, whatever, with a bunch of blue screens of death on it. I don't think this was a Photoshop. I think it was an actual photograph. But apparently most Windows machines owned by corporations, maybe that's an exaggeration, but a lot of them,
it is.
were in a blue screen of death loop for a while and may still be for all we know. So I don't know if John, you wanted
first
to
approach of all, this I was laughing my butt off when I published this episode of our show last week when I had started it by saying, "Please, tech companies, don't make any big news while we're while we're off."
I'm sure CrowdStrike wishes happened. That they listen to you.
Yes, yeah, right? That's like one of the biggest computer stories that will probably be of the year. it happens like right as Casey is on vacation and we can't record a show.
Yep, it's all my fault, and I'm sorry. But anyway, so reading from The Verge on the 19th of July, thousands of Windows machines are experiencing a blue screen of death issue at boot today, impacting banks, airlines, TV broadcasters, supermarkets, and many more businesses worldwide. A faulty update from cybersecurity provider CrowdStrike is knocking affected PCs and servers offline, forcing them into a recovery boot loop so machines can't start properly. The issue is not being caused by Microsoft, but by third-party CrowdStrike software that's widely used by many businesses worldwide for managing the security of Windows PCs and servers. So I'm going to jump a little bit ahead in our internal show notes, and there was another Verge blog post this time on the 23rd that talks
don't
about...
Don't jump ahead. The order is intentional. Intentional.
Yeah, well, but...
John's show notes?
I would like to file under protest this order, but carry on, John.
No, I'll explain why the order for the bootleg people. The reason the order is because the next item leads into all the rest of the items with the Apple angle. And once we go off into the Apple angle, we'll never come back. So that's why I wanted to insert this fun item here.
But we don't even know what happened yet. I haven't even told the people what happened.
The Verge summary covers the basics of it, right?
I am doing this under protest. I would like to formally say.
Well, all I'm saying is it wasn't an accident. It was thought out in this way.
All right, your protest is noted. Please proceed.
Thank you. All right, so I'm apparently needing to tell you next that Windows 3.1 saved Southwest Airlines' butt. I don't remember what news broke first, whether it was how Southwest's entire infrastructure is apparently run on Windows 3.1. That's not a joke. 32-year-old operating system.
Windows 3.1 predate Southwest as an airline?
No, I don't think so, but I'm not confident on
it
right
might.
About that.
I mean, you can run software that was released before you founded your business.
Well, okay, yeah.
Well, either way, when was it headline? 57 years ago, as Air Southwest in 1967. So it was closer to the genesis of Southwest than it is today, Windows 3.1 was, or at least based on my mental math. So anyways, apparently Southwest, which made news as well, separate from this, because the way Southwest works is you just get a boarding number, not a group, but a number, and you get in line based on your number, and you run to whatever seat you want, and that's your seat. There's no assigned seating. And they announced recently that they're going to start doing assigned seating, and all the Southwest nerds are very upset about it, which I thought was funny. But nevertheless, reading from digitaltrends.com, nearly every flight in the U.S. is grounded right now following a CrowdStrike system update error that's affecting everything from travel to mobile ordering at Starbucks. But not Southwest Airlines flights. Southwest is still flying high, baby, unaffected by the outage that's plaguing the world today. And that's apparently because it's using Windows 3.1. Windows 3.1, an operating system that is 32 years old. Southwest, along with UPS and FedEx, haven't had any issues with the CrowdStrike outage. In responses to CNN, Delta, American, Spirit, Frontier, United, and Allegiant, all said they were having issues. But Southwest told the outlet that its operations are going off without a hitch. Major portions of Southwest systems are reportedly built on Microsoft Windows 95 and Windows 3.1, which is something the company has come under fire for in the past several years. It should go without saying that Southwest needs to update its system, but in this case, the ancient operating system seems to be doing the airline some favors.
So I when this thing happened, I was also away on vacation, and I saw the story go by, and I saw the Windows 3.1 thing. I was like, haha, that's funny. I absolutely did not think this was real. Because it's such a, you know, typical joke of like Southwest being the weird backwards airline. They don't even get to pick your seat, although as Casey noted, they're changing this. They're running 3.1. And I refuse to believe this. I kept following. Can I find a more reputable source for this? It's not like an Onion story that's been reprinted. As far as I can tell, this is a real thing. The Southwest Airlines is running Windows 3.1. Now, we've all heard the stories of like, oh, 8-inch floppy drives control the whole transit system for some subway system, right? Because they updated it, you know, sometime in the 70s or 80s, and they haven't updated it since. Like, those are all things that happen. But Southwest is a pretty big airline here in the U.S., and it just boggles my mind that there are people that they pay to keep their systems running, and what they're keeping running is something that runs on Windows 3.1 and Windows 95. And the reason this article says it goes about saying that they should update is they're like, hey, if it works, why would they change it? Because those operating systems have massive known security flaws in them and are generally less secure and less reliable than the things that they replace. And yes, once in a blue moon, your butt's going to be saved because you're running something really old, but you're also much more vulnerable on a day-to-day basis to someone breaking in and destroying everything and stealing all your data and all that good stuff, which again also happens with modern software. But I would say in general, it's not a good idea to continue to run Windows 3.1 forever and ever and ever. It is not perfect. It is not like complete and flawless or anything like that. It is just a really old piece of software that is not getting any better ever. It's also not getting any worse, but it is probably getting harder to find systems that will run it. So I would suggest they change things. Assuming this story is real. Does anyone want to place bets? Is this a real story? Does HelloFresh run on Windows 3.1? Please say it's not real.
I don't know.
It wouldn't surprise me. I mean, I also was like, no way, but it wouldn't surprise me.
And like, what does it mean to run on? Like, does that mean like they have one computer somewhere
that
with
does
it?
Their payroll.
Like, yeah, like, it, you know, that's very different from like all of our systems. Like, can you even still buy hardware that runs Windows 3.0? Or is it all being run under emulation? Like, there's so many questions.
Yeah, or Windows 95 is the updated version. Yeah, who knows? Yeah, like I said, again, please don't send us all the stories about all the things that are running off floppy disks and tape drives, and especially military stuff and government stuff. Like, we all know that exists, but for a large, you know, successful, well-known private company or commercial company anyway, seems somehow less excusable than like a government thing or whatever, or some obscure, smaller, obscure thing. Anyway, Southwest, get your act together. And as for the assigned seating versus not assigned seating, I have no opinion.
I don't know. I've only flown Southwest a couple of times, and I think I didn't care for the unassigned seating in no small part because it's unfamiliar to me. You know, I'm not used to flying Southwest because I've only done it a couple of times, and it just seemed odd. Plus then there's like people who are saving seats, but you're not really supposed to do that, and then you get into like all sorts of unnecessary confrontations about, you know, you can't save seats and blah blah blah, and I don't know, I don't think I care for it, but I do not have strong feelings about it.
I already asked people not to send us things, and the chat room was filled with 747s running on floppy drives, the German railway running on MS-DOS, New Jersey needing COBOL programmers to fix the unemployment system. We get it, we know they exist. It's just shocking that something as big as Southwest.
Yeah. What was it that Chuck E. Cheese was running on? It was running on floppy disks or something like that, or a Palm Pilot
or
something?
Yeah, the music show was all on floppy disks, too. Yeah,
yeah, Palm Pilot. You're thinking of the IMAX Palm Pilots.
That's what, yeah, I'm conflating the two. You're right. Yep. Anyway.
Can you imagine like a worse programming job, though? Like all these other ones, running COBOL, running Palm Pilots, like those are all kind of like, you know, COBOL, there was a lot of COBOL programmers at one point. So, you know, maybe some of them are retired and, you know, want something, a little side project to do. Palm Pilot was like, you know, a fun thing people loved. Nobody loved Windows 3.1. I know. That was my first operating system as a computer user. It was fine. No one loved it. Can you imagine today having to go work on a Windows 3.1 software package like for your job? Like, oh, we need to go update this because, you know, it's still being used to run an airline, a big airline, apparently. Oh, my God.
We have the real-time follow-up for the debunking story from Kotaku. No, Southwest Airlines isn't using Windows 3.1 in 2024. So my instincts seem to have been on the right track here. We'll put the link in the show notes.
That's too bad.
Yeah, because I saw it in reputable publications. I'm like, this cannot be true. This has to be a made-up thing, but anyway, so we will put the Kotaku debunking link in there as well. Sorry for besmirching your good name, Southwest.
In any case, all right, so going to The Verge again, this time on the 23rd of July, inside the 78 minutes it took to have millions of Windows machines. At 12:09 a.m. Eastern on July 19th, cybersecurity company CrowdStrike released a faulty update to the Falcon security software it sells to help companies prevent malware, ransomware, and other cyber threats from taking down their machines. Whoops. CrowdStrike's update was supposed to be like any other silent update, automatically providing the very latest protections for its customers in just a tiny file, just 40 kilobytes, that's distributed over the web. CrowdStrike issues these regularly without incident, and they're fairly common for security software, but this one was different. And I don't think we have anything in the show notes about this, but I thought it was funny that apparently, like, New Zealand and Australia started sounding the alarm because they got these updates first. And, you know, I think on Under the Radar, certainly you've talked about this, Marco, and I think we've even talked about it here from time to time, that generally speaking, when you release software to a worldwide audience, it is common, it's like a good rule of thumb that you don't want to release it to everyone all at once. Obviously, there's exceptions and gotchas and catches and whatnot, but generally speaking, you want to kind of dole it out in little bits and pieces. And a few years ago, Apple started allowing developers like us to say, yes, I would like incremental release, where I think they release it to like 1%, then 2%, then 5%, or something along those lines. It doesn't matter what the specifics are. And that's what I always choose. Even when I'm completely confident that something's good to go, I always choose the incremental rollout because you never know. And apparently CrowdStrike did not do that. They just said, screw it, baby, we'll do it live. And they released this thing to everyone. And the people at the beginning of the day in New Zealand and Australia started saying, uh-oh. And it was already too late.
As the sun races across the earth, destroying people's computers. Yeah, we're gonna get to it in a second. The from this Verge story about what can be done to prevent this. But that, like Casey, that is my number one take home point, which is anytime you're releasing software that's like on critical systems and that you are a critical part of this, and we'll get to the criticality part in a little bit. You do it incrementally. Casey's releasing an app that lets you look up stuff about movies and TV shows. He's doing it incrementally. No planes fail to take off if Casey messes up his app. And still, why would you not do it incrementally? This is just like basic software best practice. And I worked in healthcare, which was similarly critical. You'd never release to everybody all at once if you could possibly help it. Even if you do something incredibly primitive, but they have like a pool of guinea pigs who you pay money to be your guinea pigs, knowing that if there's any problem, they're going to see it first, and you give them like a discount on the thing that you're selling or something. Like, but if you're something like CrowdStrike that's used like all over the globe, and I forget what the percentage was, but it's a fairly high percentage, I think it was like maybe 15-20% or whatever, but still, it's a large number of machines.
No, it was like 1% of Windows PCs, but it's a very important 1%.
Was it 1%? Anyway, whatever it is, it's millions of machines. And like, Why would you not have a strategy? It's not like they're a new company that is just now coming on the scene and releasing software. Like, this is their business. This is their main business, the security software. And their regular release procedure is push out to everybody all at once. I can understand having that ability, because if there's some critical vulnerability and you need to get the fix out there ASAP, but I hope that one of the things they take away from this, and we'll put a link in the show notes to their preliminary post-incident review, so where they go over what they think happened. I hope one of the internal takeaways is we need to have a way to release our updates incrementally. Not incrementally via the sun, right? Via time zones, but incrementally as in we release a percentage and then we monitor. That's the key thing. You have to, releasing a little bit at a time is only works as well as your feedback loop. And that's the kind of the flaw in Apple system, where you just like sit back there and wait to hear complaints from users or whatever. But ideally what you want is some kind of way to tell, has this update hosed our customers, right? Support call volume, feedback email address, like some kind of connection with your customers where you have like a monitoring thing. You're always monitoring this. What is our incoming support volume? How many crash reports are we getting? Like, this should be on a graph with thresholds and alerts, right? So you release to your tiny, tiny little guinea pig pool, and then you watch. And then you release a little bit more, and then you watch. Like, just doing it incrementally and going home doesn't help you, because you'll just release to everybody without anyone watching, right? Oh, CrowdStrike. Anyway, sorry.
And this also, like, can we talk yet about, like, what technically, like, the kind of update this was? Because to me, this is fascinating. Like, so it's, you know, running in kernel mode, so that's like already, you know, and there's all these politics around, you know, kernel extensions and security companies with Windows and everything, but this is a driver that runs in the Windows kernel, fully executable code in the Windows kernel. Okay, that's already like, you know, something that used to be commonplace in the computing business, but is very much not commonplace anymore for most applications, for lots of good reasons. And also, in the kernel, what these updates were not just data files. It was not like the kernel driver wasn't like, all right, here's what I'm going to load from this data file is a list of signatures of known bad malware binaries. No. What it was loading from those files was executable code. Like, so all those updates, they basically seem to be making basically like an interpreter in the kernel. And they download these data files with, again, no staging environment, no slow rollout, seemingly not much production testing. Okay. They download these data files and then execute them in the kernel. So you are directly sending code from an all-at-once non-staged rollout directly into Windows machines' kernels to execute. So if there's any crash logic in there, it will crash the kernel, which will crash the machine and cause a reboot or a blue screen. That, like, that is bonkers to me. Like, the fact that, like, that they even built the system at all, okay, that's risky enough. To have a system in the kernel that reads arbitrary executable code from outside the kernel and just runs it, that's already terrifying on a lot of levels. But then to also have it be these, like, quickly deployed, downloadable things, we're just going to deploy this code out there and just run it in the kernel and just go. Have fun. Like, that is... This was a powder keg just waiting to explode.
Yeah, I don't know the specific technical details of their update mechanism, but I have worked with and built myself lots of systems that are like this, and the reason people do stuff like this is because you always want the ability to sort of, you know, fix the airplane while it's flying, right? You don't want to have to reboot. You don't want to have to restart anything. You want to be able to just say, at any point, I can push this update in real time to the running system and it updates itself. And that leads you down the path of doing things like, okay, well, we'll just watch this directory for files. And when a file appears here, we'll load it and we'll shove it into, we'll interpret it and shove it into the memory image of the already running Like, I totally understand why they made a system like this. It's just that if you do make a system like this, you have to know what incredible risk you're taking and be like, as conservative as you can possibly be to say, if there's anything even remotely strange about this, do not update it. If do validation on every single thing we can think of. And I think part of the problem is they, you know, the thing was loading code and not validating anything about it and it was invalid or whatever. But like, I understand why they kind of why they do this. But yeah, the kernel mode thing is an issue. That's what this next part is about.
All right. So reading from The Verge, despite not being directly involved, Microsoft still controls Windows experience, and there's plenty of room for improvement in how Windows handles issues like this. If Windows determines that a driver is crashing the system at boot and forcing it into a recovery mode, Microsoft could build in more intelligent logic that allows the system to boot without the faulty driver after multiple boot failures.
I think macOS does this, by the way. I think there is a system where if it boots multiple... I may be wrong, but, like, obviously people manually do this, but, like, I think there might be an automated one that's like, hey, we tried to load this driver and it crashed last time, so now we're not loading it or we're loading it in safe mode. And again, booting in safe mode is probably not the solution here because you probably still couldn't remotely update these machines without it, but that was part of the problem is that they're crashing on boot, and because they're crashing on boot, they never can get to a runnable state, so you can't push your update to them automatically. Like, people think of, like, companies running computers as just like a person running a computer, but that's not how it is. There are thousands upon thousands of computers and a very small number of humans who have to manage them from far away, often very far away. So nobody, like, there's not like you have physical access to these thousands of computers. Somebody does somewhere eventually, but there's not enough people out there to go and manually fix computers. That was why this was such a problem. It's like, well, so what? They made a boo-boo. Just push out the new version of the software. Well, you can't push software to a computer that hasn't booted. And none of these computers could boot. So someone had to physically go to them and physically, like, boot them into safe mode and repair them. And this is not something you can be done remotely or whatever. So it was a big problem. So, you know, it's... It was a bad situation, but there is room for improvement here.
Yeah.
Well, on Microsoft's side, I'm like, because again, as it says, it's not Microsoft's fault. Like, Microsoft didn't write the bad software, but Windows needs to defend itself against bad software because in the end, Microsoft took some of the blame for this, probably unfairly. Microsoft deserves some tiny part of the blame for making Windows not as resilient as it could be. In this basic way. Like, again, this is The Verge, not some deep technical analysis knowing. It's like, hey, if you've tried to do something and it's failed a bunch of times, don't keep trying to do it.
Continuing from The Verge, but the bigger change would be to lock down the Windows kernel access to prevent third-party drivers from crashing an entire PC. Ironically, Microsoft tried to do exactly this with Windows Vista, but was met with resistance from cybersecurity vendors and, guess who? EU regulators. Microsoft tried to implement a feature known at the time as PatchGuard in Windows Vista in 2006, restricting third parties from accessing the kernel. McAfee and Symantec, the two big antivirus companies at the time, opposed Microsoft changes. Geez, why? And Symantec even complained to the European Commission. Microsoft eventually backed down, allowing security vendors to access the kernel once again for security monitoring purposes.
So this example of applying pressure, I'm going to mostly blame the virus vendors and not the EU. It's not like the EU said... So a lot of people are reporting this and saying, well, the EU told Microsoft that Microsoft, because you have access to the kernel, you have to give all third parties access to the kernel. Otherwise, it's not fair. Otherwise, you're giving yourself an advantage that they don't have, which is not a thing that they said, first of all. And second of all, is mostly kind of silly because Microsoft writes the kernel. They write code in the kernel, and no, other people can't write code in the kernel. Now, Windows does have a kernel extension feature that is available to third parties, and also Microsoft itself can also write kernel extensions. But it would be ridiculous, and again, I don't think this is a thing that the EU did, to say that because you have kernel extensions, you must forever have kernel extensions. Because forbidding third parties from making kernel extensions doesn't stop the need for kernel extensions from Microsoft. Many things in Windows are implemented in the kernel. Some of those are packaged as drivers that come with the operating system. That is probably never going to go away. If a kernel exists, it makes sense to have parts of it modularized into a driver system, even if that system is not accessible to third parties. So the idea that you could say, well, either everybody gets to write the kernel extensions or nobody does, doesn't make any sense. Because the company that makes the operating system will almost certainly continue to need to make kernel extensions to its own kernel as part of making the operating system. But again, I think this, you know, throwing the EU under the bus here is just part of the whole big regulatory thing. I'm sure they did complain to the European Commission, but the EU did not come to Microsoft and say, you are not allowed, like, issue a decree. If you're going to have kernel extensions in Windows, you must allow everyone access to it. What did happen is the virus makers said, hey, all our software uses kernel extensions. If you stop us from using it. Yeah, so the antivirus. Antivirus makers.
There's a thin line there. There's a thin line.
Sometimes the malware is coming from inside the house. I think that they applied pressure, kind of the same way that like Microsoft and Adobe applied pressure to Apple to said, hey, if you ship a new version of macOS that Photoshop and Office don't run on, that doesn't include a good way to port our apps, we're not going to support it, and you're not going to have Office and Photoshop, right? I think McAfee and Symantec said, if you ship Windows Vista without our software's ability to run on it, we're going to be super mad, and you're not going to like it, and Microsoft backed down on that. And that was, you know, Windows Vista was a while ago, right? So this is kind of older history. But anyway, I'm going to say that I don't blame any of this on the EU, really, although if the EU, I'm not putting it past the EU to come up with a wrong-headed notion like that, but I'm pretty sure that they didn't in this specific case.
All right, so continuing from The Verge, but the bigger change would be to lock down the Windows kernel. I already read that, didn't I? Hello.
It's Microsoft Tide. Oh, no, you already did that one. I think it's...
See, we're all confused. All right, there we go. Thank you. Goodbye, future Marco.
Bye.
Here, you're there.
All right, continuing from The Verge, Apple began locking down its macOS operating system in 2020 so that developers could no longer get access to the kernel. Quote, it was definitely the right decision by Apple to deprecate third-party kernel extensions, says Patrick Wardle. But the road to actually accomplishing that has been fraught with issues. Apple has had some kernel bugs where security tools running in user mode could still trigger a kernel panic, as Wardle says. Apple, quote, has also introduced some privilege execution vulnerabilities. Ooh, that's a mouthful. And there are still some other bugs that could allow security tools on Mac to be unloaded by malware.
Yep. So in our neck of the woods, kernel extensions were a thing in macOS 10 for a very long time. It's how a lot of software installed its quote-unquote drivers to work with, you know, hardware peripherals and other random stuff. And in 2020, Apple said, you know what? Kernel extensions are going away over the course of several years, in cooperation with our vendors that have things based on kernel extensions. And the vendors would say, but our software needs a kernel extension to do its job. How are we supposed to ship our software? We need kernel extensions. And Apple's answer was, whatever things you need to do, we will provide a way to do in user space, as in a process that is separate from the kernel. So that if your code crashes, it's not inside the kernel and the kernel keeps running and the operating system stays up. And bit by bit, piece by piece, Apple has been rolling out user space versions of things that used to require kernel extensions. And what Patrick is saying here is sometimes Apple rolls out those things and they're bad and they have bugs. And still, you can end up crashing the kernel because there's something on the kernel talking to the user space thing. And if the thing on the kernel that Apple wrote has a bug in it, it can take down the kernel. It's a long, slow, painful process. Third parties don't like it, especially third parties that have kernel extensions. They may say, you know, back when we had a kernel extension, we had really smart people on our team, and they wrote a really good kernel extension, and we debugged it over the course of 10 years, and we think it's a bulletproof. And now our choice is to use this user space thing that Apple is offering that connects to Apple's own little thing in the kernel, and their thing in the kernel sucks and has bugs and is brand new this year. This is a downgrade. So people are angry. But Apple is taking its lumps and causing disruption with its eyes on the prize of no more third-party code running inside the kernel. And that's, you know, we make the joke about courage with Phil Schiller and with the getting rid of the headphone port or whatever, but in some respects, it does take courage to essentially endure the pain and the justified anger of your developers if the goal is a future that is better for everybody involved. It's better for users, surely. It's better for Apple. And in the end, hopefully, it will also be better for third-party developers who don't have to write that super high-risk code that runs inside the kernel.
Yeah, yeah. It's a tough nut to crack, right? And everyone has both, you know, selfish and unselfish motivations for it. So I don't know, but apparently there is an official API for this, and there is even a WWDC video from 2020. The API is Endpoint Security, and this is reading from Apple's developer site. Endpoint Security is an API for monitoring system events for potentially malicious activity. Your client registers with Endpoint Security to authorize pending events or receive notifications of events that have already occurred. These events include process executions, mounting file systems, forking processes, and raising signals. Develop your system extension with Endpoint Security and package that in an app that uses the System Extensions framework to install and upgrade the extension from the user's Mac.
So that's the equivalent of, if CrowdStrike existed for macOS, it would use Endpoint Security, which is a user space API that connects to a thing that Apple wrote inside the kernel, and that's how every sort of antivirus, anti-malware, anti-whatever thing made by third parties on macOS must use Apple's Endpoint Security system, which is new and has bugs and is not as good as when you could write your own kernel extension, but in the long run, it's better to have, in theory, one vendor, who's the vendor that makes the operating system, writing the thing inside the kernel that everybody else, all the third parties, talk to, and they're out there in user space. So all those third parties, if they crash, they don't take down the operating system. But if Apple crashes, that they do. That's the theory behind it. Again, it's not always a smooth road to get there because people complain that the thing Apple wrote is not as good as the thing that they wrote before. And for a long time, they're going to be right about that. But the thing is, there's many third-party developers and just one Apple, and hopefully, eventually, Apple will iterate on its endpoint security thing and all the other stuff they have inside the kernel, talking to those user space processes. And once it gets ironed out, that makes it better for every antivirus program and every Mac user. You don't have to wait for every individual third party to get up to snuff or whatever.
Finally, Microsoft does what you would expect. It calls for Windows changes and resilience after CrowdStrike. Reading from a new article on The Verge from the 26th, Microsoft wants to reopen the conversations about restricting kernel-level access inside Windows. Quote, this incident shows clearly that Microsoft Windows must prioritize change and innovation in the area of end-to-end resilience, says John Cable, Vice President of Program Management for Windows Servicing and Delivery, in a blog post titled Windows Resiliency, Best Practices and the Path Forward. Cable calls out a new VBS Enclaves feature that does not require kernel mode drivers to be tamper-resistant and Microsoft's Azure Attestation Service as examples of recent security innovations. These examples use modern zero-trust approaches and show what can be done to encourage development practices that do not rely on kernel access, says Cable. We will continue to develop these capabilities, harden our platform, and do even more to improve the resiliency of the Windows ecosystem, working openly and collaboratively with the broad security community.
Yeah, so Microsoft is, you know, working on the same things that Apple has done, which is let's make user space equivalents of all the stuff that used to require kernel access. But they're apparently have not gotten to the point where Apple has of flat out forbidding kernel extensions or making it extremely, extremely difficult for them to load and requiring all sorts of hoops to jump through and all that other stuff. And real-time follow-up, someone in the chat room said that CrowdStrike does exist for the Mac. So there you go.
Yeah, and Linux too, I believe, actually.
Yep. Yeah.
All right. So then, you know what? It's all good. All is well that ends well, because CrowdStrike is taking care of their customers. They are doing what's right. They are offering them a $10 apology gift card on Uber Eats for the outage.
When I saw this, I'm like, this has to be fake. Like, there's no way.
Just like
the
Windows 3.1 thing. This has to be a joke. But yeah, this is in TechCrunch, so I'm gonna click on it again. Have they updated and say this is a joke? I think this is real.
I don't know.
As far as I know, it's real.
Because they have like first party sourcing. So it was, you know, one person said that they received it, and so did somebody, I think, at TechCrunch or whatever. $10 gift certificate is not going to cut. I think we don't have the links in here, but I think like a bunch of the, I think Delta's like suing them for $1 billion or something. I should have put that link. I did have it somewhere in the notes. I just didn't get to it in time. But I think it's Delta Airlines, is suing CrowdStrike. And I think that is actually interesting because, as anyone who has used software for a long time knows, there's a thing called end-user license agreement, and surely something that is equivalent in enterprise software sales, that usually says, in all caps somewhere, words to the effect, we don't guarantee this software does literally anything. We don't, like, whatever you think this software does, you're paying us money, and we're saying we are not promising that it will do that thing at all, ever, under any circumstances.
Right, and furthermore, if we break your stuff, if we delete your data, if our software does anything to harm you, you
not
agree it's not our fault, because we couldn't possibly be held to the standard of making worker software.
Now, again, I'm not a lawyer, and I know there are certain things that you cannot put in a contract and sign away all your rights or whatever. So the courts in our country will figure out whether Delta is owed billions of dollars from CrowdStrike or not. But I do have to say this is a fun test because, normally these things don't get tested because we click through the end-user license agreements because we're like, yada, yada, yada. There's nothing we can do about it anyway. What are we going to do? Sue Microsoft? Sue Apple? Like, we don't have that kind of money, right? But Delta Airlines does. So Delta Airlines versus CrowdStrike will be another interesting test of end-user license agreements. Can CrowdStrike make Delta Airlines agree that they pay X amount of dollars per year for essentially nothing? Right? For saying, we're giving you money and we're signing a contract that says, in exchange, we expect nothing from your software. Whatever you're telling us it does, if it doesn't do that, we're saying that's okay. Because that's what all the end-user license agreements say. Because lawyers put it on that in there early on, and they got away with it, and we all just ignored it. And I'm sure there have been other tests that have tested EULAs. I don't know what the law precedents are or whatever, but this is a fairly high-profile one. So I think I'm assuming they'll just settle, so there'll probably be no precedent set here. Because what's going to happen is Delta's just going to extract a bunch of money, and they'll settle out of court, because that's what they'll do. But it would be fun if it actually went to court and actually established some legal precedents. If a listener knows what established legal precedents on enforceability of EULAs is, please let us know. But I imagine a lot of these cases get settled, because in the end, Delta just wants some money to make up for all the money that they lost. I saw a graph somewhere of takeoffs per minute per airline, right? And as you can imagine, during CrowdStrike, it went down, but Delta's graph was so much worse than everybody else's. I don't know why it was so much worse. Maybe there's a lot of Delta flights or whatever, but there was a dip in the overall global takeoffs per minute, but Delta was plummeted to almost nothing. It was terrible. So good luck, Delta, getting some money in that settlement.
Yep. We will see what happens.
I mean, this all is right. All the whole CrowdStrike thing here. I think, the bigger story here is first of all, that this company, I think, was doing things in a pretty reckless way. But second of all, you have to, as a company, as a computer user, you really have to weigh the value of malware prevention software or malware defense software against the malware. What likely outcomes are they actually protecting you from? And how can the malware itself go wrong? And, throughout my entire...
The antivirus software.
Yes, that is what I meant. You're right.